and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for being with us tonight. Tonight I have with us a guest, Ken Peters, who has a really short, neat, compact book that I really like called Health Secrets for the 21st Secret. And it's a very easy book to read. It's not complicated and you know, hard to read with details, but it's a very easy book to read to talk about vitamin deficiency or nutritional deficiencies and how you might know symptomology. Thank you, Ken, for being with us. I really like your book. It's a good, easy, you know, grab in a minute and look up some stuff book. It's a good one. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. And yeah, my feedback is that it's basically a layman's guide. I've worked in the industry for about 25 years, and I'm able to sort of cut through the marketing hype and give people the kind of advice they don't always get from marketing material. For example, one of my big things is skipping weekends. And you're not going to have a company tell you that because they're going to lose 20% of their sales. But for the average individual, it's a safer way to take nutrients and a more efficient way to take nutrients.
Well, before we get into all this stuff, tell us where we can find you.
Well, my book's available on Amazon.com. I do private consultations. I do those online, and I have a website, kenwpeters.com. And then I do blogs, and I do product research and design for NutriStart. So most of my blog material is available at NutriStart.com.
And they can find your book where?
At Amazon.com.
Okay.
Or on the NutriStart.com.
I have a lot of things that I want to talk about with you, but why do you say we can skip weekends? Tell us why.
Well, there's two basic principles. One principle is that fat-soluble nutrients and minerals, unlike water-soluble, the excess does not pass through you. So, for example, I'm one of the people who believes in high levels of vitamin D, and that's a pretty contentious issue right now, what's considered a safe, effective level. Well, if you take too much and you skip the weekends, your body can use that up. If you take too much iron, which can be dangerous in excess, your body will use up any storage. The other principle is that if you ingest too much of a substance at a higher level than food would normally provide, and B vitamins would be a good example, 50 milligrams of B vitamins would take you almost a month worth of eating food to get. And when you take that at one time, if you take that every day, your body gets sloppy and lazy. It doesn't store efficiently, and it doesn't use efficiently because it assumes you swim in that nutrient and it can just forget about it. So it makes the body tighter. We're feast and famine creatures, and if we're constantly feasting, it puts a burden on the system. And as I've mentioned in the book, B vitamins are almost all synthesized, and so they actually have to go through the liver because they're perceived of as a chemical. So they can also put a little burden on the liver in excess. So a break just makes everything more efficient and safer.
What is your background, Ken? What qualifications do you have to talk about this? And by the way, I just want to tell my listening audience, neither one of us are physicians, and we're not attempting to treat or diagnose you. We're just providing you with information.
Yeah,
that's
what I do.
We're just giving you information.
Yeah, I'm a research and development guy. I'm mostly self-taught. I started off going to Misho Kushi's Macrobiotic Institute, so you'll notice I have a kind of slight oriental bent to the materials because the Japanese macrobiotic tradition is very food-based and has some very logical components to it. Then I moved into just personal interest in health foods, and from that developed my understanding of vitamins, and at some point was approached by NutriStart to help him fine-tune his product, which back then was a packet of vitamins, was the only product line he had. And I would point out that his beta-carotene was synthetic and thus not an ideal form and perhaps detrimental, and what better forms of minerals he could use. And eventually I started working with John at NutriStart and doing R&D for him and developing products for him and for Proline Nutrition and some other companies. So I just built my knowledge base organically in the field, personal interests, going to lectures and consulting with experts and things.
Sounds like we have a great deal in common. because I have the same kind of passion and I do the same kind of thing. It's I often find anybody that does that goes as deeply as I do. It seems like sometimes the people with the least amount of organized education, we try harder to find out more sometimes, it seems.
Well, and you also have that jack of all, master of none thing, where specialists tend to have tunnel vision and not look outside their field. And then when you embrace it all, you get an overview and you start to see where things link up that others might not have noticed.
Well, I'm not gonna do your interview in the order that you have them, okay? I hope you don't mind.
Oh, not at all. It's no expectations.
We do supplements on here or nutritional things all the time. So my listening audience is, kind of familiar with stuff. So I want to talk about something first that we haven't talked about. And I always tell people when we talk about diet that, whatever works, because I had a massive heart attack a year ago, and I've elected to only use diet as my treatment. And everybody goes, oh, tell me what you do, because I've had such great success. And I go, I do this diet, and I say what it is, but I really think that it has something to do with your blood type. And I don't know why I think that, but I can look at me, and I can look at, my partner and my kids and my friends, and we all get different results with the same diet. So I'd like for you to talk about that blood type. I thought that was great.
I am a great believer in the blood type. And the medical profession doesn't think much of the blood type diet, but they do have to admit that certain blood types get certain types of diseases more than other blood types. For example, type A gets more heart disease, and I'm an AB, and A is not genetically suited to the consumption of meat, but when I grew up, there were no vegetarians, never heard of such a thing, so it wasn't even a dietary option. So you could see why that blood type might be more prone to heart disease. They also have shown that if you take the lectin, which is the sort of offensive protein component from a lentil, and inject it into a rabbit, you'll give that rabbit rheumatoid arthritis. Now, a professional might say, well, you don't inject food, but the fact is with leaky gut that in essence you do inject food. Because of my thesis, as you've probably noticed in the book, is that almost everything comes down to leaky gut. If we're deficient in vitamin A and D, and a couple other nutrients like iodine and B12, we start getting a thinning of our mucosal membrane from the sinuses down through the gut, leading to a host of problems. When you add antibiotic use, candida overgrowth from mercury fillings and such, the antibiotic causing candida overgrowth, we start getting a porous gut, and genetically modified corn is extremely bad for that right now. So when the gut becomes porous, then these offensive lectins that are particular triggers to your blood type, they do get into the bloodstream, and they trigger antibody response, which looks to a doctor like an autoimmune response, and they trigger inflammation in weak areas of the body, which can vary from person to person, and they trigger insulin spike. So for my blood type, chickpeas essentially would cause me to be hypoglycemic and be fattening, even though theoretically a bean should be great for everybody. It gets very specific in the foods to the specific blood type. So once you've thickened up your gut lining, you can have a lot more indiscretion with the blood type. But almost everybody I consult with, I have them follow the blood type diet at the same time as they're thickening up their mucosal membranes.
So, and again, we're not attempting to treat or diagnose here. We're just getting information. But if you would briefly tell us how you thicken up gut linings and give us an idea of brief things that each blood type should or shouldn't have. Briefly.
Well, I do have a brief synopsis of the worst things in the book here. I tend not to remember them off the top of my head except for my own blood type, but I'll just have a reference to it.
I can so relate to that.
But my general thesis, the thing I promote the most that's most commonly deficient is vitamin A, and that's because the only appreciable source really is liver, and most people don't eat liver anymore even if they do eat animal protein.
Are we still talking about blood types?
Yeah, thickening up of the lining of the gut.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so if I have a party with sinus problems, lung problems, food allergy problems, all that's part of the same mucosal membrane. That's part of your tube. And vitamin A deficiency, vitamin A has been made the bad guy in the press. A lot of studies linking it to birth defects and osteoporosis. These are horribly flawed studies, and I've analyzed them and picked them apart on the NutriStart website, on the blogs I do there, and to some degree in the book. So I'm extremely confident that we can take a lot more vitamin A, and the more you squint in the sun, the more deficient you are in A, and the more A you take, the more that squinting goes away until you know you've got sufficient A. Vitamin D, we're now realizing that 400 IU is not enough, and where I live in Canada, there's only 4 months of the year you can get enough D from the sun, and then you have to be half naked and unwashed, because if you take a shower with hot water and soap and strip all the oils off your skin, you're not going to get D from the sun anyways. So I'm one of the believers that we need about 3,000 to 5,000 D a day on average, and for therapeutic, often I suggest people use 10,000 for a week, skip the weekends, then continue on with 5,000 5 days a week. So A and D are the two most critical nutrients, and the third one is iodine, which is also commonly deficient in the West. If you don't eat seaweed, essentially you're deficient in iodine. Western thyroid tests are useless. They don't tell you by the time they tell you you have a thyroid problem, your only option is Synthroid, because you've lost 70% of your thyroid function. So iodine is also
especially
important.
Now, hold on.
Let's
talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about that just for a minute.
Okay.
When you say, by the time they tell you that you have a thyroid problem, what do you mean by that? You mean just merely being hypo or hyperthyroid a little bit?
Well, generally, your doctor will say your thyroid's fine, your thyroid's fine. Your thyroid's not fine, you need Synthroid. Because at this point, it doesn't have the ability to actually function anymore by the time it shows up on their tests. We had a doctor here, Dr. Derry, who still has a website, who wrote a book on iodine and breast cancer, and he would give people the thermometer test, where you keep a thermometer by the bed and check your temperature every morning, and that tells you if you have suboptimal functioning. But his practice was taken away because he was simply recommending high levels of iodine and this alternative thyroid test, and it did not match what the Canadian Medical Association considered to be appropriate, because you have to follow the party line when you're a doctor. So thyroid function, generally most people have a problem with thyroid function. The thing with iodine is that there are receptors through the entire body. So when you get iodized salt and it's potassium iodide, or you get potassium iodide in your supplements, that only goes to the thyroid. It doesn't go to the ovaries, the prostate, the lungs, the heart. There's iodine receptors throughout the body, and iodine's a critical nutrient, even more so with Fukushima and all the radiation that's currently in the environment. And there's a few other things required for radiation, but iodine's first and foremost. So iodine's part of the mucosal membrane. I've had people avoid surgery for postnasal drip just by adding small amounts of iodine to their supplement regimen. So, yeah, I'm a big believer that AD, iodine, and then for older people, B12 is also part of your mucosal lining, so that gets down there. And then we move into the ancillary nutrients like L-glutamine, which serves a host of functions, including rebuilding lining, and things like DGL for people with ulcers, the deglycerized licorice that helps rebuild lining if the esophagus has been damaged or the stomach lining has been damaged. But essentially AD, iodine, and B12 in that order of importance.
And how long do you think it takes to do that? Is it,
well, it would take
that
months.
You have to do for the rest of your life, or is it once it gets thickened, does it stay that way as long as you maintain that kind of diet, a good diet?
I think once
diet.
You get it rebuilt and you maintain a proper diet, then you don't have to continually take those nutrients. Now, I don't eat higher than fish on the food chain, so I'm not going to eat liver. So I'm going to continue to take vitamin A. And I live in Canada, and I don't sunbathe that much, so I'm going to continue to take vitamin D. As I get older, I may take more B12, again, because I don't have a high meat-based diet. Plus, I'm AB blood, and A and AB blood are prone to low stomach acid and thus low B12 levels. So I'm going to compensate in that case. Generally, I eat seaweed, so I don't supplement that much with iodine because I try to use a tablespoon of DULS a day. So in that case, I can get it from my food. So it really depends on what you can get from your food and what you can't. And, you know, everybody's diet is the best, right? The paleo diet's the best, the vegan diet's the best, the macrobiotic diet's the best, whoever you talk to. But that's where blood type fits in, is that some people do just feel great when they start eating meat again after being vegetarians. For other people, I find the idea, repulsive personally, but I'm an AB, and it turns out that that perfectly suits the diet I have, perfectly suits my blood type. There are exceptions. I've met large, muscular people who are A's, and they simply can't get by on a vegetarian diet. They require animal protein to feel balanced, and other people need animal protein to be grounded. But generally, I advise a combination of the macrobiotic principle, which is eat food that grows within 500 miles of where you live, so you're in tune with the seasons, and modify that with your blood type to find out which areas of grains and proteins and legumes and
now,
such are best suited.
We've talked about your blood type. Can you talk about the others just for a minute for those that have a different one than you?
Okay, well, I've got here the
A, the B, and the O.
Yeah. So the worst defensive foods for each blood type, for the type A blood, it's red meat because they're low in stomach acid. Another common issue is people have low stomach acid, but the symptom can be heartburn or reflux. So often a doctor in a knee-jerk reaction puts them on acid blockers, which are one of the worst things you can take. So acid reflux and heartburn can be caused by low stomach acid or high stomach acid. Generally, you want to do a little test with apple cider vinegar or betaine hydrochloride to confirm whether or not your acid's low or high before you decide what to do. But for type A and AB, they have low stomach acid genetically, so they tend not to digest red meat very well. For the type A, tomatoes, potatoes, bell peppers, so that's your nightshades, they're going to contribute to arthritis quite a bit. Whole milk products, though fermented cultured dairy products, because the lactose is reduced, are easier to digest. Bananas and oranges. For type B, and type B has a lot of problems because chicken is one of the worst things for them and literally leads to rheumatoid arthritic conditions, very inflammatory. Pork, it's interesting because a lot of European Jewish people are type B blood and always been advised against
pork
for a
long time. Wait, what did you say about Jewish people? What did you say about that?
They tend towards type B blood from the European.
Interesting. My little boy, he's 14. We're Jewish. I wasn't born Jewish, but he is. And he just flat does not want to eat chicken.
No.
And all the time you're talking, I'm just sitting here thinking, that sounds like my kid.
Yeah, well, this
that
could
sounds
just
like
be
maybe
an
that's
intuitive
why he doesn't
response.
Want to eat chicken.
Exactly. Now, turkey is okay for that blood type. And even eggs aren't so bad. But chicken, pork, shellfish, corn, wheat, rye, lentils, peanuts, and sesame and sunflower seeds, and tomatoes. So all those things, inflammatory or insulin spiking. For AB blood, which I am, which is the rarest blood type, there's only 4 or 5% of the world that's AB, they avoid red meat, chicken, shellfish, sesame, sunflower seeds, corn, bell peppers, bananas, and oranges. And then O, they're the most common. That's hunter-gatherer blood. It's the original blood type that everybody had before the agrarian revolution. They are most suited to the paleo diet. They're most suited to meat consumption. And the worst thing for them is wheat, gluten, dairy products, corn, eggplant, lentils, and potatoes. So, you know, well, it's part of the nightshade, too. So it'll be
any
inflammatory.
Any nightshade or just eggplant?
Just eggplant in their case. Tomato, it's not on the list currently, but Peter DiDamo's book, Eat Right for Your Blood Type, that he's got a website. I highly recommend picking up the book for people. And he's got an even more detailed encyclopedia book that goes into all the foods in more details. It's something worth understanding if one has any health issues. And outside of that, it's worth just following basically those principles 80% of the time to prevent future health issues.
That's very interesting. Gives me something to think about. So the next, I'd like for you to tell us why those, talk about inflammation and why those, how those things, that's why actually why we're talking about this, because of inflammation. So I'd like for you to talk about inflammation, C-reactive protein, because I know a lot of people have that problem today, especially in the United States. I don't know about up there, but they do here. And just cover inflammation as best you can, if you would.
Well, the blood type diet is the big factor. When you've got the leaky gut and the offensive lectins bleed into your system, they're going to trigger inflammation. We're all well aware of the imbalance between omega-6 and omega-3 in the modern diet. So the omega-6 oils, soy, sesame, safflower, sunflower, corn, all those things, their omega-6, they tend to be about 20% higher than the omega-3, which is mostly fish and flax oil. So people are quite aware that we're deficient in omega-3, and that has a huge impact on inflammation. The problem with meat is when you feed corn and soy to animals, their meat then becomes inflammatory. So people who want to eat meat in a healthy manner, they want it from grass-fed animals. That's quite the big thing now, and that's also from the Weston Price angle, is that K2 is found in the meat and dairy from grass-fed animals. So to eat meat in a healthy manner, you really don't want factory farm meat. It's also got to the point where here in Canada, they can't even make sausage from the intestines of the pigs. They have to import gut lining because of the genetically modified corn is eating holes in their guts so dramatically. So avoiding omega-6, avoiding animals fed high omega-6 foods, and emphasizing omega-3s in the diet, that's a key factor for inflammation. Then the blood type diet's a key factor for inflammation. Those are the main factors, really.
What about, you talked about C-reactive protein, and there were some different herbs that you talked about that you could do to lower that?
Well, there's a tomato extract that's called Nutristar used to sell it, Natural Flow. It's LOM, it's called, and it's a hybrid of tomato. It's extremely high in lycopene, and it's been shown to reduce C-reactive protein. Krill oil's been shown to reduce C-reactive protein. I believe pomegranate juice also has been shown to reduce C-reactive protein. What I always tell people is when you're getting a blood test, it's more important for the doctor to check your C-reactive protein than it is to check your cholesterol levels, because cholesterol doesn't cause heart disease. It's when cholesterol traps in the arteries, and C-reactive protein indicates inflammation, indicates your body's more likely to be trapping cholesterol in the arteries and leading to a narrowing of the arteries. It's part of the whole problem.
So let me ask you this. I had a conversation with a physician the other day about this very topic, about C-reactive protein as it relates to MTHFR. You know, people who have MTHFR mutation, if they undermethylate or overmethylate, they can get a lot of inflammation in certain parts of their body. And some doctors, I don't think they realize that, and so they see that high C-reactive protein number, and they automatically assume that it's in your arteries, but it can be if you have something like MTHFR. Can it be, do you believe that it can be, you know, related to those undermethylation or overmethylation, particularly if you have a lot of viruses? Does
well, I'm not that? Familiar with that theory. I know methylation's critical, and, you know, B12 deficiency causes a lack of methylation. SAMe encourages methylation. Folic acid, B6, those are the same basic things that prevent homocysteine buildup, which also causes inflammation in the arteries. So those basic Bs are critical to methylation. I did remember that C-reactive protein's lowered a lot by fiber, so we end up back in this kind of Western diet where people have a low fiber intake and a high acidic diet with sugars and a lot of animal proteins, fruit juices and things, and that all contributes to increased C-reactive protein.
You write about yucca, too. You're the only person that I've ever seen write about that short of Amy Yatsko. So,
well, I used it in a formulation, one of our arthritic formulas that we sell at Nutristart, and it has saponins in it, which help it clean out the joints. A lot of times when people get older, they get calcification, uric acid crystal buildup in the joints, and it's hard to get glucosamine in there to rebuild the cartilage because the space is occupied. So things like alfalfa and yucca will wash out the joints and then allow cartilage rebuilding to occur within the joints. Yucca was sold by a multi-level marketing company for a lot of years as an arthritic cure with great success, and of course it's been used for centuries down south. It's also considered to create a proper balance in the intestinal tract by keeping down the bad bacteria. And often, you know, candida overgrowth, bad microbes, those are going to cause inflammatory conditions too.
Okay, that's interesting. So let's talk about, now we can go back to your book. I wanted to start off with inflammation, so we'll go back to the order now. B vitamins. You want to talk about that? That's a great hot topic right now in the world because of the MTHFR. Could you talk about, and cholesterol and, well, not cholesterol so much, but how we metabolize fats and things. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, bees to me are one of the weak links in supplements because they are synthetic white powders made by pharmaceutical companies. And because nature doesn't put 50 milligrams of each B vitamin in that level, so you tend to see B complexes come as, you know, 25 milligrams of every B, except for maybe the folic acid and the biotin, which have different ratios. But so bees, to me, you want to be careful with. They can be hard on the liver. Time release is an ineffective technology for B vitamins because they're picked up in the upper intestinal tract. Pills sink to the lower intestinal tract. So you're better to take your bees more frequently. Now, as I pointed out in the book, there's a good place for high doses of bees, and that's the orthomolecular nutrition principle, where if you have schizophrenia or bipolar, Dr. Abram Hoffer would use high levels of B3, I think mostly as a serotonin producer, and he would use that instead of drugs. And as somebody pointed out, your body doesn't recognize Prozac, but it does recognize B3, and it can construct serotonin from B3. So as an alternative to drugs, much easier on the liver, then certainly high dosage levels under professional guidance is a great idea. For the average person, you don't need a lot of bees if you have a good diet. You just want to ensure that you're not deficient in anyone. So I usually don't recommend much more than 25 milligrams, which is found in a good multivite, about 5 days a week again, so the body doesn't get dependent on that. That still would take you about 12 days of eating food to get the equivalent of 25 milligrams of most of the bees. There is the food form vitamins, where you feed the synthetic bees to yeast, and then you harvest that yeast, and then they're complex structured. So while the potencies are low, the assimilation's higher, companies like New Chapter and Megafood. So in theory, those are superior ways of taking it, certainly easier on your liver. I say in theory because they've yet to actually show any science. So if I want to tell you that B3 produces serotonin or that B6 folic acid and B12 reduce homocysteine levels and help prevent heart disease, I can show you the science. You can go to PubMed, you can look it up, you can find reams of science on it. With these new food form vitamins, in theory, yes, they sound better, but they've yet to show any science saying that our low level of B6 increases blood levels more efficiently than a synthetic B6. Bees require minerals, thus you're best to get your bees in a multivite anyways. And again, skip the weekend so you don't overdose on them. But I tend to be more conservative with the B vitamins than most of the other nutrients.
That's interesting. So can you talk a little bit about the individual B vitamins? I learned after I had my heart attack and got on my regimen, I learned so many things about the importance of things that we've never heard, that you don't usually hear of: biotin, inositol, PABA, pantothenic acid, P5P, the form of B12, methylcobalamin. I certainly wasn't aware of the importance of all those and the role of inflammation and heart disease. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you certainly could write a book on virtually every B vitamin. Each B vitamin does depend on the others, so if you're going to take a therapeutic dose of one B vitamin, like for cholesterol, B3, you have to get up to about 1,500 milligrams. You've got to take the rest of the Bs, or you'll set up an imbalance because they are a family. B1, the thiamin, is mostly used for digestive functions and things, but it's reduced by alcohol in the body, so people who drink a lot require the B1. And B1, little known, is that it helps keep mosquitoes off you. So a lot of people in the northern parts will take B1 because it makes the blood smell unpleasant. B2, you know, cracks in the side of the mouth is a symptom of extreme B2 deficiency. And it actually works with the A and D to help rebuild the mucosal membrane. So the B complex has a wide range of benefits. I mean, you could just go on and on about both most of them. The dermatitis, inflammation of the mouth, skin lesions, those can all be linked to B2 deficiency. I'm a big fan of B3. As I said, Dr. Hoffer's used it for a wide range of mental ailments, and it's been shown to reduce cholesterol. Lately, we found that the flush-free B3 is not effective for cholesterol. The time-release B3 is dangerous to the liver, but the newest thing is sustained B3, which is like a time release, but a different mechanism where it's layered with cellulose, and it's been shown to be highly effective on cholesterol levels. If you've ever taken straight up B3, you know you get this red flushing of the skin as the histamine releases. So usually a person starts with a 100, and then they keep adding. As they build a tolerance, they keep adding till eventually they can take a 500 comfortably. Eventually they can take the 1,500 comfortably. With the sustained release, you can jump right to 1,500 and get to the therapeutic dose level. Dr. Hoffer himself was taking about 4,000 B3 up until his death in his early 90s. So you consider it a longevity substance. It's especially good for circulation. When you take that, you get that flush, you have a mottled skin appearance, and the areas that are still white are areas that blood flow shut down on. And if you keep doing the flush consistently, what you'll find is you get this even sunburn look, which shows that you've blasted open circulation to the blood at the areas where that started to shut down. So B3 is niacinamide, causes no flushing, no circulatory benefits, and it doesn't help with cholesterol, but raises serotonin, so it can be used for an anti-anxiety substance. So B3 is one of the most important therapeutic compounds. B5 is pantothenic acid, and that's most commonly used to support adrenal health. You tend to take that at higher doses than I mentioned. You tend to take that at about 250 milligrams, up to three times a day, sometimes even more to support adrenal health. And B6, again, along with folic acid and the B12, is part of regulating homocysteine, so keeping the arteries clean from cholesterol buildup. B6 helps produce dopamine, so it's important for mood function. The B3 produces the serotonin, which is calming, and the B6 produces the dopamine, which is excitatory and elevates the mood. Also, B6, along with magnesium, helps to prevent kidney stones. B12, yes, I'm a big believer in the methylcobalamin form. That's the one that works on the brain the best. So high levels are used for neurological conditions like ALS, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis. At the lower levels, most people, you know, take 1 milligram a day if you're elderly, up to 5 milligrams if you're showing the beginnings of any neurological problems. B12 should be taken sublingually, dissolved under the tongue. That's why doctors inject it, because we tend to lose the ability to digest it through the gut as we get older, if we're type A or AB blood, and if we have a low animal protein diet. So, you know, if you're those blood types, if you're vegetarian or vegan, you're going to come up with a B12 deficiency younger than most people who they tend to have to be elderly before it shows up. It has been said that if doctors were liberal with B12 injections, they could cut senile dementia in half. So it has quite an effect on that.
You know, that was something that happened to me. I got to the point where sometimes I can't find words, and it still happens. I have to actually do injections. And when I get to the point where I start stumbling around for words, you know, kind of stuttering around, I realize, that's how I went from doing the sublingual tablet to injecting, because I couldn't use the sublingual kind, and I found out because I couldn't find words. And the doctors would all say, oh, it's your hormones or this or that, and it turned out just to simply be I couldn't get enough B12.
So even sublingually wasn't as good as the injection for you?
Mm-mm. No.
Yeah, I've heard that from others, too.
It gave me this really fun, and I want my listeners to know this, it gave me this really nervy thing, neuropathy, on the bottom of my feet and by my toes, kind of like Morton's neuroma.
Mm-hmm.
And on the bottom of my feet, it would sting and burn, and my tendons and my legs would get really, really tight. It'd feel like they're going to pop. And I used every kind of alpha hydroxy B12, and I use regular methylcobalamin. I use cobalamin. I use all the different forms, and nothing worked but the shots.
Wow.
And it's funny. And within an hour after giving myself the shot, the symptoms went away. Blew my doctor away. He just didn't believe it would be.
Are they using cyanocobalamin or methyl?
Methyl.
Oh, it is methyl. Okay, well, that's a pretty good point. I guess in some cases, the sublingual is even not enough. For the tendon, which is much close to cramping, generally magnesium helps relax those sorts of things, late cramping.
It was different. It wasn't a cramp. It was like it became very hard from my foot to my hip. I don't know how to describe it. It's just different. I mean, I take 5 CalMags a day, CalMag butyrate, and then I take 2 magnesium glycinates 3 times a day, and then I take 2 magnesium carbonates at bed. So I get, plus I do magnesium lotion sometimes. So
well,
I've got a
total,
lot of mag.
What's your total calcium?
I do 4 or 5 CalMag butyrates a day.
Do you know the elemental amount of calcium in there?
I'd have to get up.
The point is that you really don't want to get up to 1,000 calcium. That's where it becomes dangerous and linked to stroke and heart disease. That's commonly what doctors recommend, 1,200 to 1,500 calcium, but it's excessive. The human diet traditionally provides about 300 to 500 milligrams of calcium a day. So the reason calcium is dangerous is because it steals magnesium, and people are more commonly magnesium deficient than calcium deficient. So I generally suggest people try to average no more than 500 calcium as a supplement in a day, skip the weekends, and at least an equal amount of magnesium. And then if they have
high blood pressure
or severe leg cramps, then they should just take the magnesium alone at that level for a while.
I do that because to get the butyrates.
And the other
only product I can find is that.
Yeah, that's a rare form, all right. The other thing about...
Duchenne makes it.
Oh, not familiar with him. Who is that?
Anyway, sorry.
Right.
Patricia Kane.
Oh,
she's
okay.
Doing really, really good work with membrane stabilization and detoxing of metals and toxins. Anyway,
yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead and talk. So
and
your
then
next
the
chapter
other,
is...
Well, I was going to say when words are on the tip of your tongue and you can't quite grasp them, that's often lecithin really helps with that. That's where the B's, choline and inositol are found in lecithin, and it creates acetylcholine.
I actually do IV phosphatidylcholine that I get from Switzerland.
Yeah, and that's the only way worth taking lecithin in a pill, since common lecithin pills are only a third that strength. But, yeah, that's also great for the membrane or for the myelin sheath and for short-term memory retrieval, as well as keeping fatty deposits off the liver and out of the arteries. So it's an old-school one, lecithin or phosphatidylcholine, but it stood the test of time. Works really well.
It's a good thing. So
Your
next topic is vitamin C. Do you recommend vitamin C? How do you recommend it?
Well, it is a critical nutrient. We are one of the few creatures on Earth that no longer produces it. And there may be valid reasons that evolution caused us to stop producing it, but you can eat an orange that tastes perfectly good and has no vitamin C in it because it's been in cold storage for a year. So it's hard to rely on fruits and vegetables for vitamin C. The old school, Dr. Pauling's approach was simple ascorbic acid, and you would take it to the bowel tolerance point, the level at which it gave you the runs, and then at that point you would back off and you would know that you had enough vitamin C. These days, people are a little more concerned about its acidic nature, and that's why the chapter is entitled, Is It Worse Than Sugar? Because when you chew it, it is worse than sugar because it's more acidic than sugar is and hard on the tooth enamel. But when you swallow it, you don't quite have that problem. Ascorbic acid is going to run through your body in about 2 hours. If you buffer it and you get a calcium ascorbate, well, it's going to stay in your blood about 3 times longer than that. It's going to be non-acidic, which is important if you're taking high grammage. It doesn't much matter if you're taking 1,500 milligrams a day. That's not going to add to your acid load. But if you're taking 6 or 10 grams in a day, that is going to add to your acid load. Unfortunately, it's also going to add to your calcium load. If you take 10 grams as calcium ascorbate, you're going to get 900 milligrams of calcium, which has to be factored into your supplement regimen. So then they have multi-mineral ascorbates, where the form of mineral that's bound to the ascorbic acid could be zinc, magnesium, potassium, etc., which is a better choice for high dosage levels. You get a glutathione spike from 500 milligrams of vitamin C, whether it's buffered or just ascorbic acid. So if you're going to take 1,000 milligrams a day, you're not going to get any more of a glutathione spike. As you're aware, glutathione is part of your immune system, part of your detoxification pathway, so it's critical, especially in modern times, for good health. So you're better to take the 500 milligrams at two separate meals than the 1,000 at one meal, because then you'll get a couple glutathione spikes. So if you're not well, you know, you're going to want to take higher levels because it does more than spike glutathione. It builds collagen, it's involved in detoxification. But I feel a minimum of 500 two, three times a day, up to high grammage, depending on a person's individual needs.
So we have about 10 minutes, maybe 12 minutes left. I'm going to give you an opportunity to talk about whatever you want to talk about, if you want it.
Well, I do believe people have to, most of your listeners are probably internet savvy and so well aware that the governments are not talking about what Fukushima's leaked over here. I think it's very important to consider that there's a lot of radiation in the environment and moving up through the food chain into the dairy products and into the meat products. The West Coast was washed in radioactive rain when it first blew. As the debris washes up in our oceans here, the radioactive water that's been dumped in the ocean every day since it went is going to wash up here. We're starting to see melting starfish over here and herring with bleeding eyes. And
really?
We've lost most of our scallop, 80% of our scallop industry. They're attributing it to ocean acidity. But if you take the Oriental approach, and the thing with macrobiotics, which is, as I said, what I originally started studying, is they're Japanese. They observed that after Hiroshima, the people who followed the traditional macrobiotic diet based on seaweed and brown rice and miso soup did not get radiation sickness. And they view things in a yin-yang approach, which is akin to acid-alkaline. And for them, chemicals, pesticides, drug chemicals, and radiation, what they all are is acidic in nature. And miso has been shown in rat studies to reduce radiation uptake. So really the diet that protects you against radiation is essentially the diet that protects you against everything, which is focuses on alkaline foods, which will vary somewhat from blood type to blood type. Brown rice is a staple for them. It might not be quite as appropriate for a type O blood, but you can use the pH strips and you can chart your alkalinity. And maintaining an alkaline diet and then maintaining a lot of antioxidants, because radiation causes free radical damage, those are critical things for modern living. In the sequel to this book, will be about radiation and electromagnetic pollution, which to me is another huge issue, wireless and smart meters. These are all these invisible things that are hard to track but are slowly making us all ill. And I'm a big believer in finding alternatives to coping with EMF pollution, too. I've seen a number of people severely damaged by that. But L-glutamine is one of your best choices. Pardon?
Are you friends with Magda Havis?
No, not familiar.
She's from Canada somewhere, and she's writes profusely on dirty electricity.
She
might be a good person for you to connect with. She's up there somewhere. I don't know where.
I'll keep my eyes out. But yeah, it's dirty electricity is your standard wiring that's done poorly. So that's your ordinary EMFs. Then you have your radio frequency from your wireless and your smart meters, and of course all your neighbors' wireless and all your neighbors' smart meters. I have a lady friend who became very ill, was living in an apartment building. Well, all 12 smart meters were in the electric room by her kitchen because they put them all from each floor into one room. And then they sold space to 15 cell phone towers on top of the apartment building.
Wow.
People living in those circumstances are getting dosed with these things, and heart problems are one of the clear issues, lung problems, shortness of breath, anxiety, high cortisol levels. And, you know, it's really hard without the right measuring devices to know if those things are in your space or not. So, yeah, to me, those are the big things for the future is radiation and electromagnetic pollution. Those are the things we have to start looking at protecting ourselves against. And electromagnetic pollution tends to affect people under high stress because their cortisol goes up, and then that further drives the cortisol up, and then you end up with a lot of health issues that come from high cortisol. So maintaining a balanced diet is the first and foremost thing. Certain supplements with radiation, as I said, iodine is important. Strontium is very important because there's radioactive strontium. That's what particularly goes into dairy products. And strontium as a mineral is amazing for reversing bone loss. A friend of mine had his bone mass, and he's in his 70s, rebuild 5% over 2 years with strontium. At the same time, it's protecting you against radioactive strontium. And boron's another important mineral that not only helps build bone mass and regulate hormones, but also helps keep radiation out of the body. And you can take a bath to pull radiation out with a cup of sea salt and a cup of baking soda, a good 20-minute soak, and then step out of the bath before you drain it. If you drain the bath while you're standing in it, the radiation rises back up into your body because it's a pernicious little thing. It's not like a heavy metal. It's almost more like a gas, you would say. So it follows the highest density. But I have 8 pages on radiation on the NutriStart website under my blogs. So I've got a lot of material on herbs, supplements, and diet and things that you can do to cope with radiation on that website.
You want to spend the last few minutes talking about the end of your book and talk about prostate, the for men?
Well, like I say, the product mentioned there, Natural Flow, is called LOM. It's now only going to be available through pharmaceutical companies because they bought it up, so we won't be selling that anymore.
Really?
And it was
what's in it?
It's a hybrid of tomato that's extremely high in lycopene. Because lycopene alone as an isolate doesn't really do anything. The FDA wouldn't allow it to make any claims. But when you eat tomato sauce with oil, you naturally raise your lycopene levels. So this concentrate's been shown to be effective at lowering PSA levels. Other than that, you know, there's standard things for the male prostate, which is saw palmetto and pygium and beta-sitosterol. Generally, for most people, those things work along with zinc and selenium to protect the prostate, and the pomegranate's especially good for lowering PSA levels too.
Okay, let's see, what else did I want to... Adrenals. Everybody has adrenal insufficiency, and we've got about 7 minutes.
Well, one of our best-selling products with the NutriStart company is the Adrenal Start, and I've had women in menopause, men in andropause, young women have given birth, people who've found that product's just turned their life around because it's a really good adrenal rebuilding formula. And when your adrenals are malfunctioning from high stress levels, your cortisol goes up. That makes you prone to belly fat, which is the most dangerous kind of fat. And then your DHEA levels fall, and that means the sex hormones become out of balance. So in the West, when you hit menopause or andropause and the sex glands decline in their production of the sex hormones, if you have healthy adrenals, they'll take up the slack. They'll produce more DHEA. That'll balance out the sex hormones. But we all tend to be overstressed in the West from a lifetime of stimulants and high-stress city living. And now I'm going to add cortisol elevations from electromagnetic pollutions. So rebuilding the adrenals, in Chinese medicine is very close to what they call kidney essence. That's the closest thing. And kidney essence is linked to longevity, vitality, and sexuality. And you can say the same about the adrenals. Again, in Chinese medicine, the most important thing is digestion, so you can absorb those nutrients and from diet and supplements and herbs. And then the second most important thing is kidney essence for longevity. And in our case, it would be adrenal health. Vitamin C and pantothenic acid support the adrenals, and then there's what you call adaptogens. And every country's got an adaptogen. Ginseng was the first and foremost. rhodiola is very hot now. I'm a big fan of ashwagandha from India, Siberian ginseng, suma. All those adaptogenic herbs, we pretty much want to take them on a semi-regular basis to keep the adrenal glands healthy and functioning well.
What's a semi-regular basis?
How often is that? Generally a month on and then a week or two off, or rotating from one adaptogen to another. In the Adrenal Start formula, we've combined seven or so adaptogens from different countries, balancing out their heating and cooling tendencies. People take it for a month, and then they take a week off, and then they use a lower dose or as needed, or if they have severe malfunction, they go back to another month's worth. But always a little bit of a break. If you have liver problems, don't take milk thistle all the time. Take milk thistle for a month, then use either a liver hydrocellate formula or a mushroom formula or an Ayurvedic formula. But we tend to climatize to a herb if we use it excessively. So because we're hunter-gatherers, and again, feast and famine creatures, you want to skip weekends, take breaks, and cycle things. And that just makes it all more efficient.
So why do you not want to take milk thistle all the time?
Well, you'll climatize to its effect after a while. If you take milk thistle for 1 month, and then the next month you take an Ayurvedic formula, which is helpful to the liver, or a mushroom formula that's liver-specific, you're taking a different tack at approaching the liver, and it's not going to get too used to the same substance continually.
What
just rotating these things.
What do you think about N-acetylcysteine?
It's great for lung problems. When you get above 1,500 milligrams a day, it can produce free radicals. And it doesn't elevate glutathione any more than 500 milligrams of vitamin C, which is a lot cheaper. So for severe liver damage and for lung conditions, I think it's a good therapeutic. I don't take it as an ongoing supplement. I tend to think of it as more of a therapeutic use.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Any other thing that you for sure want to talk about before we hang up?
I'll just say that where I do consulting at a vitamin store that I work at part-time, I have photocopied my A and D recommendations. And that, again, if you have ongoing sinus problems, you have lung problems, bronchial problems, cough that won't clear up, food allergies, if you have an autoimmune condition, anything that I believe is linked to the thinning of the gut, what I recommend to people is they take 50,000 vitamin A for 5 days, then they take 30,000 vitamin A until they don't squint in the sun. Then they take 10,000 vitamin A as a maintenance dose. Again, skipping weekends. Vitamin D.
I want to write that down. Start over. I had to get a pen. How much vitamin A?
50,000 natural source vitamin A.
And what is natural source? What
generally, it's derived from fish liver oil. And for a good company, generally it's molecular distilled, so it's very clean. So you take with fat, anytime fat is in a pill, whether it's A, D, K, E, Q10, you want to take it at a meal with fat. You have to be chewing fat to send the signal to the stomach that fat's coming down, so it properly digests it. So you take 50,000 a day for 5 days. Then you take 30,000. Each pill is 10,000 on average. You take 30,000 5 days a week until you don't squint in the sun. And then that means you have sufficient A, and you can roll that back to 10,000. And you can let it slide for a while, too. With the D, I suggest, and D doesn't work very well in a tablet, just the way Q10 doesn't work well in a tablet, or K2, because they're all fat-soluble. They work better in a soft gel in a fat base. Add a meal with fat in it. You take your vitamin D as drops or as soft gel capsules. You take 10,000 a day for 5 days, and then you take 3,000 to 5,000 based on your personal inclinations or your own health or your exposure to sun. Dr. Hoffer used to suggest 10,000 D a day through the entire winter just for SAD. But you can't take more than 5,000 D a day unless you've got K2 and A, because those are cofactors for D. So those are two main things.
Sorry, Ken. Thank you. We have to get pulled off the air. But thank you so much for coming on. I think your book is great, and it's called Health Secrets for the 21st Century by Ken Peters.
Yeah, available on Amazon, or you can go to my website, kenwpeters.com. Thanks
Thumbs
for having me on.
By me. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Have a good evening.
Take care. Bye-bye.